Hi, my name's Dave Farley, and welcome to the Engineering Room podcast, where we seek out influential and interesting people from the world of software. Some of the world's best developers and thinkers to pick their brains to discuss their ideas, and occasionally to challenge my own on what it takes for all of us to make better software faster. The Engineering Room series is sponsored by Equal Experts, and I'd like to thank them for their ongoing support. So if you'd like some help building some great software or are interested in finding a great place to work, do check their links in the description below. My guest today is an experienced executive with a proven track record of transforming software development and delivery processes in large organizations. More than that, I think of him as an ally in the common cause, because we both worked in parallel on ideas that have since had a significant impact on how we all think about and practice software development. Well, I was working on and leading teams that gave birth to the ideas of continuous delivery, as we describe it today. Gary was doing the same thing with the HP LaserJet team, who were also pioneering new ways of working at larger scales. As the R&D director over at the HP LaserJet firmware team of around 800 people, he led productivity improvements of between 2 and 3 times. Gary is now an independent consultant, and his goal is to help as many people as possible to achieve similar results. He's a consultant, conference speaker, and author of several fascinating and important books, including Starting and Scaling DevOps in the Enterprise, Leading the Transformation, A Practical Approach to Large-Scale Agile Development, and Gary's newest book is called Engineering the Digital Transformation. In it, he provides systematic approaches for improving how software is developed for a broad range of applications. Please welcome my friend Gary Groover. Hi, good. Gary, how are you?
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for agreeing to take part today. So let's start with your experience at HP. I know there's lots more to your stuff since then, but I've been recommending your book about the HP LaserJet experience for many years, almost since it came out. It describes the transformation in a large, if you'll forgive me, failing development organization and into a dramatically more effective team, and wonderfully shows the evidence for the impact of that transformation and what happened. Do you remember the moment when it kind of clicked for you and you realized that you were onto something really important there?
You know, we were going through trying to solve a problem, right? We were stuck. We had a new architecture to get out. We're trying to get better and trying to learn because the business was dependent on it. And towards the end, I kept looking at my program manager and saying, this is fundamentally just changing our lives and we ought to write a book. And he's like, whatever. And finally, we were on a trip to India and our flight got delayed for 9 hours and we just sat down and started writing. And then we kept writing. And then we wrote on the trip when we had jet lag. And by the time we got back, we had 2/3 of the book done. And then it took another year to get HP and the publisher to agree to publish it. But it was kind of when we started doing things that we never thought were possible at the end of the journey that really sunk in that sort of, we should try to share this and try to help other people if possible.
Well, one of the things that I really liked in that book and that I've quoted you a lot on is the kind of before and after picture of the time and effort and what you, the kinds of things that the team were working on before and after your change. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, where you were before and what forced this need for change to?
Yeah, and it's probably worth pointing out, you know, one of the more interesting things to me when I published the book, we tried to figure out how to publish it, and we ran into Jim Highsmith, and he read the book and said, gee, I really like this, and sent a link to the publisher to get it going. And then he finally talked Martin Fowler into reading it, and it was like, Martin finally read it and I met him at a conference. He said, I really like your book. First of all, he knew who I was, which was like, wait a minute, Martin Fowler does. Do I have? And then he said he really liked the book as one of the better things written. And I couldn't figure out what attracted to him so much. And then recently, Jim Highsmith wrote his book on The Wild, Wild Rest to Agile, 60 Years of History. And one of the things that they pointed out was that software. They figured they had to do software differently because it was a complex adaptive system and people had to learn and adjust. And up until that point, all the stuff that had been done with Agile was really at the team level and what they had to do. And I started to realize that a lot of what we did differently at HP was we kind of did Agile upside down, which is to say, we took it and sort of said, our Scrum team was my staff of myself and, seven or eight section managers and three technical leads and a program manager. And we were learning and adjusting the whole way and trying to figure out how to respond. And our goal was to get this new architecture out, get it done, and get it out there. And so we were constantly learning and adapting. And I think that's what stood out for me. And it wasn't until I read that book and saw that Ken Beck sort of said, we realized software was different. We needed a complex, we needed an adaptive approach for a complex adaptive system. And that really sunk in for me. And I kind of it kind of hit me as like, that makes a lot of the things that I've been trying to put in context make sense. And I think one of the worst things the Agile community did was tell leaders, your role is to, support the change, get out of the way, and empower the teams, and just and the types of things that we drove and the changes we made happen wouldn't have happened and couldn't happen at the team level. And I tried to capture a short history of that, and I tried to write stuff for executives that they were patient enough to read. So I got it down to 18 pages, and it was going to be my fifth book. And at 18 pages, it's not a book, but at 18 pages, it probably matches the attention span of the target audience. And so I tried to get the whole story down and simple, and then here's the things that you can do to improve.
Yeah, we'll put a link to the descriptor to that white paper
And that'll help.
in the
And 18
description.
pages is about 45 minutes, and you should be able to get through that. And the types of things. Oh,
Sorry,
go
go
ahead.
ahead. No,
No, no.
please. So there's a lovely quote. I'm probably going to paraphrase it rather than quote it, but something from the Harvard Business Review, which said that we don't need evidence that this agile thing works or can work in all sorts of different places. The main barrier is the behavior of executives. I think that's true. There's the huge part that's often missed about this is to imagine this being a technical change when it's not. It's a behavioral and organizational and cultural change, much more than it's a technical change, it seems to me.
What I think the Agile community did wrong is they focused on the teams and told the executives to get out of the way. And when they did that, the teams learned how to be adaptive and how to monitor this complex system and adapt and respond. And the executives still wanted a prescriptive approach and deterministic results out of the system and give me this plan and deliver it because that's how I do everything else. And we didn't teach the leaders that, when you're managing and leading a complex adaptive system, you need to take a fundamentally different approach. And it's not, give me these metrics or give me this complex framework. And if I just do the framework right, it'll solve my business problems. You need to be much more actively involved and engaged to influence the priorities for how this complex adaptive system is going to evolve. Ensure that it's aligning with the business objectives for the organization. And that's the role that I don't see people playing. It's like they hire consultants, they bring them in and say, train my people how to be agile or train my people how to do DevOps. And then all of a sudden the world will work and magically it's there. And I try to avoid those two terms whenever I'm talking with leaders or executives or anything. And the main reason is people have preconceived notions about what those words mean. And they have pre-prepared arguments for why it won't work here. And so the last half of the white paper is just, here's all the things you can be doing to improve your software development delivery processes in very common sense terms.
I several years ago, so I was working with my fr I was the head of software engineering building a financial exchange, and my friend was the CTO, and he went out for dinner one day with the non-technical CEO of the organization, and And the CEO at one point said, "So what's all this agile stuff about? I don't understand it." So Martin, my friend, said, "Well, you know, in a normal software project, you know, we do all of this work, we plan all the things, and then it all goes to shit, and you know, everything breaks, and then we go into emergency change control. Agile's like emergency change control from day one," which I thought was quite a good description of what it's like. It seems to me that you and I have said some similar things. We've said a lot of similar things in different ways, but one of the things that's on my mind right now is, it seems to me that fundamentally we've made a huge mistake in the software industry of trying to treat it like a production problem. And we don't have a production problem because for us, production is simply cloning the sequence of bytes that represents the systems that we built. What we have is a design problem. It's a much more creative discipline than most organizations think. And that puts us firmly into this complex adaptive system territory. And trying to treat that as a cookie cutter kind of repeatable production line style process, which is what most organizations, it seems to me, attempt to do, is simply the wrong model. It makes no sense in a software point of view. And it seems that fundamentally, profoundly, as soon as you embrace that idea, you're already on a better path.
I agree and I disagree. So
good.
So the part I agree with is working with the business to write software to come up with something new and creative is very unique and different. And the types of things you do to improve that are very different than the types of things that you do to improve other things. But there's also part of the software development delivery process that are very repeatable. You know, I want to get an environment. I want to deploy my code. I want to, you know, run my tests. All those types of things that you and Jez outlined early on in your continuous delivery book are repeatable processes that can be automated, they can be optimized, they can be improved to allow more bandwidth for working with the business to come up with those new ideas. You don't want to get distracted and waste a lot of time and energy on that stuff when you can fix it once and for all. And a lot of organizations are still stuck wrestling with those repeatable processes. So yeah, for those things, the types of things we do, we automate, we get consistency, we get repeatability, we shorten the time frame, we make them easier to run. We take the friction out of that process.
I certainly agree with that. Where I think I'd slightly disagree is first, absolutely. You know, I think of it in terms of controlling the variables. So certainly if we're doing something that is repetitive, let's automate it and version control it so that we control the variables, which gives us the freedom to more easily change things. And that gives us the freedom then to experiment at the level of the business and the level of the features of the system, the requirements that we want, what our users need of the system, you know, and that's the radical change. The technicalities are the tools that facilitate what continuous delivery, to me at least, really means. Continuous delivery is the continuous delivery of ideas, business ideas, into the hands of users. And that's what we're really optimizing for. So the problem is that the repeatability is always contextual. It's within the context of a particular application development or a particular team or collection of teams. And so we, you know, each team needs to figure out how to do that. And I think, to my mind, that's what Jez and my book was really focused on, is how you figure that part of the problem. But that I always saw that as a tool to get to what you're talking about, I think, which is the broader organizational contextual stuff of the real impact of software development. Is the focus on outcomes rather than process and mechanism.
And I think that creative part of writing software is one of the biggest things we can do to get better at that is to build in quality.
Yes.
And in manufacturing, they build in quality by controlling the process, because the process creates a product. They create the same product over and over again, and to get the same result every time, they control the process. Well, in software, it's not the process creating the product. It's individuals working with the business to try to understand the problem they're trying to solve, that's trying to learn. And the way we build in quality there is we try to get them the best quality feedback we possibly can as quick as they can. So if you're working on it, how do you get that signal? How do you get that information? How do you learn and respond? And if that feedback is delayed by weeks, months, and you know, ideally we want that feedback from the customer. If we can't get it, then we want that from some sort of business representative. But how do we get that feedback quickly and learn and adjust?
Yeah.
And I think that's the key to learning how to do it. And you know, large organizations that have lots of people working together just have a lot of friction in the system that's slowing down that ability to learn and adapt.
Yes. And that's the overhead that I would think of that comes from trying to treat this as a repeatable process. That more creative aspect of learning and discovery is what we're optimizing for. So in my book about software engineering, that's really what I talk about. I talk about two pillars of an engineering discipline for building software, one of which is to optimize for learning, and the other one is to optimize to manage the complexity of the systems that we build. And then there's a lot more detail about those things. But I think both of those things come together in being able to take a more, from my point of view, engineering disciplined approach to, as you say, remove the low-hanging fruit. Let's fix the easy stuff. Let's make what we can reproducible, and then allow us the freedom to focus and do the real value work, which is not the reproducible stuff. It's the creative stuff of figuring out what are the right things to do and doing those things and trying them out and experimenting and all those kind of things.
But what's really interesting is the types. So if you look at the friction that's slowing organizations down and getting in the way, the types of things that we improved at HP would have never been done by empowering the teams and getting out of the way. We've taught the engineers how to be adaptive and responsive because we've understood it's a complex adaptive system. We did nothing for the leaders except for say, go away. The way you're working now is really annoying. It's getting in the way and it's causing problems. And we never told them a more productive way to interact with these complex adaptive systems. And we never taught them how to think about it that way.
Yeah. So let's explore that area for a little bit. So what do you see as the role of effective leadership in organizations like these?
Well, you need to start with the vision and objectives for the applications that you're trying to create. You know, at HP, there were a few things that we did. I came in and we were struggling with getting a new system up and going. You know, we were trying to create copiers. We had printers. We put a scanner on top, and all of a sudden you could scan to an email. And it was like, oh, well, wait, there's all sorts of security concerns associated with that. What if I put the CEO's name in and just send something and spoof it and do all that sort of stuff? So all of a sudden we needed to be tied into the enterprise security systems. And, you know, Microsoft was changing a lot of times. This was 15 years ago. And we couldn't keep up with the changes and everything that was going on and everything that we were doing. And so we were struggling. And the leader that had the organization before me came in and sort of said, we need to do a complete rewrite of the system, and we can no longer battle to keep up with Microsoft. We're gonna embed their systems by putting it on Windows XP, and there's a big new copier coming out as a big investment by HP. And we didn't want to waste any money or energy on that. And so instead of trying to catch up with them, we decided to embrace it. And we developed this on embedded XPE. And so all of a sudden we got all this security system, but it meant a complete rewrite of the system. And I took over the organization, and they weren't looking for somebody to figure out a different way to do it. They want somebody to execute on that. And by the way, we needed all the current features of the current systems with the rewrite, and we needed to be done on this date and just get it done. You know, there were a couple of things I realized. One is our environment, we had a lot of branches because we had branches for products released in this window and that window. And when you're developing firmware to go and software to go in products, a lot of times you've got to deal with the product variability. And a lot of organizations, if they don't have a good product abstraction layer, deal with that variability by creating a bunch of branches. So I said, yeah, as a business and a strategy, we can't afford these branches. And not only do we need to do XPE, but we need to also scale the CE, because it wouldn't be affordable for the printers with that high-end software system. So as a leadership team, we understood that and we needed that. The other things we looked at are things that, when I go into the organizations, there are things you can do within the team that are within your control. But if you've got a largely tightly coupled system that you have to release the software together, the biggest sources of inefficiency are not on the team. They're across teams and how the teams come together to deliver work. And being able to look across those, identify those, help the organization see those, and prioritize those for improvements were some of the biggest wins we got, right? We decided we needed to go and invest a lot in test automation. We realized Trunk was getting broken quite a bit, and so we had to create quality gates. There's just a whole bunch of things that, as an executive looking over the thing, we needed a different approach. And then the other thing, that when you're driving a change like this, there are big organizational changes, right? We need the people to embrace new ways of working. And you can influence that maybe within your team. It's hard to influence across teams. And as a, in a leadership role, we've got to take that. And one of the biggest things we did is we did Agile upside down, right? We didn't go to consultants. We learned ourselves how to learn and adapt and do that sort of piece, and how to do that. And there were big changes. Like, you know, when we started this, traditionally we would have gone into a planning session to plan this re-release and spend a few months. And instead of that, as a leadership team, we said, well, we can't come up with a plan to ask for more resources because there aren't any more. We've got this deadline, we got to get it done. Let's focus on our energies on how to get it done. And we went down this path of saying, what can we get done in the next 30 days and what will make the biggest difference? And we started with the architecture, and then month by month, we learned and adjusted. And at the end of it, we were bringing in 75,000 lines of code turmoil a month. We had probably 10,000 hours of automated testing for all the different products running on a bunch of different servers every day, and we're keeping those passing at 90%. And if you would have told us that was possible in the beginning, we would have told you were crazy. I mean, it was so radically different than anything that we'd ever done. It wouldn't work. And until you lived it and felt it, you didn't realize what was possible. And so if you're gonna like do a prescriptive plan for how to do this, how do you plan for something you don't even think is possible?
Yeah. I think the secret to that is, which I think is interesting, is I think you said the secret to that earlier, which is that small steps thing, is that, you know, that willing to, as Kent Beck said, embrace change, but take that kind of experimental mindset of saying, you know, as you said, what can we do now that's going to have an impact next month or next week, or, you know, within a few days or whatever it is? How, you know, let's try and work on those kinds of time horizons. And yes, we've got that flag on the hill of where we want to get to, that set our constraints and set our sense of direction, but we don't know what all of the steps are. And it's wrong for us to predict what all the steps are at the beginning. We're going to define what the route is, small step at a time, as we learn more.
And what are we going to monitor? It's yes, really interesting. I think one of the biggest mistakes leaders take is, I want to come up with metrics so I can measure the teams and know how the teams are doing and hold them accountable for delivering on what they need to deliver for the business.
Yeah.
Instead, we need to think of these metrics as, how do we monitor how this complex adaptive system is evolving, so we know how to influence the priorities to make sure it's evolving in the right way to deliver the business value that we need to do. So instead of the leaders being something outside the team holding them accountable, we need to engage with the teams. We need to look across the teams. We need to monitor how it's evolving. And as Deming says, leader's job is to create systems that enable employees to be successful.
Yes.
And I see very few software leaders playing that role. And I
Yeah.
see lots of software leaders saying, okay, I'm empowering you, I'm getting out of the way, but I need a way to measure and drive you and hold you
Yeah.
accountable and try to force you to behave. At the same time, they're driving on things and they don't understand the frictions of getting in the way. And if you want the organization to improve, you got to understand the friction in the system, prioritize removing it, and making it more efficient so that people can be successful in the jobs that they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's so pervasive, and some of those inappropriate measures are so pervasive that it's really, really hard to get past them. I think of the idea of hitting debt of define optimizing to make sure that you can hit your deadlines is a mistake. What's the point of hitting your deadline if you're doing the wrong thing? So I'd much rather optimize to be able to make progress efficiently in small steps, and that seems like a much more efficient way of working than trying to arbitrarily hit some predefined, release date or whatever else. And of course, release dates matter, and that sort of thing is important to a business. But there are lots of other things in business that don't work like that. If you set a business target of for profitability, that's not necessary, and you don't make it, on the day that you said that you're going to make it, that's not deemed a failure. It's a tool that you use to head for. It might be something that you use as a direction of travel, but it's not a meaningful goal. If I get there sooner, does that mean I'm wrong? It's just kind of crazy to me. And that gets so much in the way. That kind of measure gets so much in the way that it often pushes aside. We have these weird conversations about, there's been a recent, it's a, I think it's just misinformation and just trying to market a book, but there's been a recent thing that's crossed my event horizon. Somebody claiming that agile projects fail 268% more than other kinds of projects. And basically they're measuring it based on whether they hit deadlines or not. And that's the wrong question in an agile project. Sure, it's important not to waste money. Sure, it's important to be focused on customer value, but an arbitrarily predefined deadline is assuming that we can predict the future. And there are lots of things that we do as human beings where we can't predict the future. Software development's one of those, it seems to me.
It's interesting that you describe you use the word agile to say that there's failures. And what was interesting for me is I went at HP and we wrote this book on agile and I got a lot of recognition. And it took me a while to realize I'd done agile upside down because when I went to another company and they'd rolled out agile in a big way, the way that the agile community described it in a large organization where you empower the teams, you get out of the way, and the leadership's just not empowering the team, getting out of the way and trying to measure them. It was very much the leadership team was measuring them on predictability. They
Yeah.
weren't trying to respond and adapt. And they were measuring the teams on how well they did agile.
Yeah.
It was the weirdest, most unagile thing I'd ever seen. Compared to what we did at HP and what they were doing,
Yeah.
it just seemed really weird, but it was the industrialization of agile. And how you roll out training and how you roll out that whole thing that sort of said, if you just stand up in your meetings and sit down, then you're going to be successful. And
Yeah.
it wasn't the mentality of, no, we went from this prescriptive way of doing things to this sort of, we got this complex adaptive system we need to learn and evolve. It was, no, here's how we run the meetings and here's how we do things. So when you say agile, do you mean what Kent Beck and Jim Highsmith and Martin
Yes.
Fowler and the leaders of the community were trying to create? Or do you mean what shows up in most organizations when they bring in consultants to tell the leaders, you get out of the way and empower the teams. And because, you know, the leaders, you guys micromanage too much. And then you get a product owner or a scrum master that's in there micromanaging at levels that I've never seen a manager ever do. And so it's just like this, I think as a software organization community, we screwed up when we didn't provide a role and teach the leaders how to deal with the complex adaptive system. And I think it's completely messed up. And what I tried to do is reset that and then not use the word agile, not use the word DevOps, because people are going to argue with them, and just come up with some very basic common sense principles that are harder to argue with, harder to refute.
Absolutely. And certainly I'm biased, but I think that continuous delivery does that. If I treat continuous delivery as a fairly holistic thing. I think of it in terms as of this philosophy of software development that's kind of, you know, that's based in kind of what I'd think of as engineering principles, but very much based on inspect and adapt. And one of the deep philosophies that I think is important there is this freedom to make mistakes. We need the freedom to be able to try stuff out, see what works and what doesn't. If we don't have that, if we assume that we've got to get everything right first time, we're not going to get anything right, ever.
I was on the phone with the leader the other day and said, I got this problem in my organization. I got this big argument about architectural directions, which way should we go? And I was like, well, okay, do a prototype. Prototype both solutions, figure out the least amount of code you can write to develop a thin slice of that architecture. And the answer usually falls out.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, that hadn't occurred to me. I thought we had to get it right and go all in. And do this big bang architectural change. It's like, no, prototype some stuff. There's only so much you can learn by putting together slides and arguing about things. You're going to learn so much when you start writing code and learning how to evolve and adjust.
I've been fortunate to meet, I think I'm fairly sure the majority of the signatories to the Agile Manifesto, and some of them are my friends. And I think all of them are kind of deeply disappointed into the way that Agile has landed in the industry, based on what you said. There are these two Agiles. I quite like Pragdave Thomas's take, which is that the goal is agility, not some word agile in quotes. What we need is that we need to adopt a literally more agile response to being able to, you know, try things out, see what works, and adapt to what doesn't and what does. But you've got this other, the one that everybody assumes is this kind of highly bureaucratic, it's essentially waterfall in disguise, as far as I can tell, for most organizations, the way it's interpreted. As you say, largely because this lack of the, I don't know whether it's the willingness or the recognition of the need for the organization to change and the leadership to change, as well as the adopting things like stand-ups, which may or may not be useful for a team. That's just a technique.
And I think it's the leaders that we didn't give role to. Right. We told them if the teams change, you'll get the results you want. And we never explained to them that the reason the teams want you out of the way is you're not changing.
Yeah.
And we haven't helped them understand what their role is, the types of things that they need to be influencing, and that this is a complex adaptive system. And you can't use the same approaches. I mean, that's what the Agile leaders came up with that and sort of said, we've been trying these standard management practices for 20 years and they're not working because it's a complex adaptive system. And so we need to do things differently. But that's something the teams do, not something the leadership does. And I think that's where we fundamentally missed the boat.
Yeah. So we started this part of the conversation sort of enumerating some of the qualities of what more effective leadership looks like in a more effective agile with a small kind of approach. And you talked about the vision, and I think we probably touched on being, I'm not sure whether we did this or not, but I would add to that being outcome focused rather than process focused.
I mean, as a leader, you want to understand what you want this complex adaptive system to do.
Yeah.
And you need to be constantly monitoring it, and you need to be constantly adjusting and adapting your priorities to influence it to do what you need it to accomplish.
Yes.
And that accomplishment can be, you know, the business value you're trying to create. It can be reducing friction so you have more of your capacity to focus on that business value.
So that those things all seem to be my kind of visual metaphor for that is what I call planting the flag on the hill, you know, establishing the, you know, the general saying, take that hill, you know, saying the goal is to land people on the moon and bring them back safely. It's to set the big, you know, the big picture target. And that might refine over time as we learn more things, but always having a clear picture of what the current vision is and the sense of direction it is. What then is the role of leadership in trying to help an organization achieve that, you know, those goals? I wonder whether this is where so I guess what I'm trying to tease out is you could read what you're saying as being very contentious. It's all down to the leaders and the self-empowered teams and all that sort of stuff don't really matter. I'm not quite sure I buy that. I'm not quite sure that that's what you mean. So I'm just trying to pull these things together.
If you're doing same things with the self-empowered teams and the teams are doing and making progress, great. Let them do whatever they want to do. I'm saying that that's a second order effect. If you don't deal with the first order effect of coordinating the work across teams, and if you've got an architecture where teams can work independently and independently develop and deploy code, great. Empower them and get out of the way. If you've got very small applications where people are just doing separate things, great. Empower them. But if you've got one of these larger complex systems, and let's be honest, not everything's a mobile application or a website, or we build complex, large things with software that require lots of people working together in coordination. And, you know, working with the business to understand what to deliver can be done at this level, and you can do that. But a lot of the inefficiencies and the friction that's keeping you from being able to do that at the rate that you're doing it is across teams. You know, what's the process for releasing code? Can that small independent team release code to the customer on its own? If not, if it has to go through a release process, if it has to go through some environments, who's going to look at that problem? Who's going to solve that solution? The teams are more likely to focus on the things within their span of control and their influence, and they're not likely to take on these bigger challenges. And, you know, changing those things and keeping Trunk more stable and having a productive place to work where it's not full of defects and you can see how your code's working and you can get feedback is really frequently outside the span of control of these small empowered teams. And if somebody isn't going to sort of champion that and influence and make sure it's happening, you're not going to get to the agile philosophy of we need to get feedback from our customers more often.
I absolutely agree. And I think if I'm honest, without sounding big-headed, that's the kind of role that I played through quite a lot of my career was being that kind of technical leader that did that kind of thing from a technical point of view. I think from my point of view, I was a technologist who kind of recognized enough the importance of the business impact and the kind of those you know, product visions, for want of a better term, or whatever else that we wanted, to be able to contextualize what I thought we needed to do and to help teams do that. I think that you were doing the same thing and coming from a different direction. You were coming from a less technical background, but into doing the same. But I think in many ways we were approaching the same problem, just from slightly different directions.
Yeah, a lot of, if you look at people in the industry and where it is, you need to look at what their backgrounds are to sort of explain their positions and their philosophies. And, I was given an organization, 800 people that had to deliver this new architecture and had been the bottleneck for 2 decades. And I'd grown up through process improvement and manufacturing. And it's like, how do we get that better? And, when I wrote the EDT book, I'd finally come to the conclusion that, manufacturing had created a systematic approach to continuous improvement, and software hadn't. And it was part of it was this whole belief that, you can't with software because it's new and unique and creative. And yeah, there are parts of it that are that way, but there's also parts of software that are repetitive. And so it was, how do we, when you walk into the manufacturing floor, you can see the process. When you walk into a software factory, you just see a bunch of people sitting around computers, and it's hard to see and hard to feel. So how do you think of that as a process? How do you make it visible? Because the hardest part of it, how old's the continuous delivery book? Is that like 12
It
years
was,
old
we
now?
it was, so so we started writing it 4 years before it was released, but it was released in 2010.
Right. And so 14 years old.
Yeah.
The ways that we can improve stuff are becoming fairly well known. The hard part's getting people to invest in those improvements and embrace new ways of working. And if we can't get past that organizational change management, that resistance to change, we're not going to see the benefits. So a lot of my energy is gone that way. And if you've got the leadership team taking an adaptive approach to managing this complex adaptive system, and they're really trying to learn what the system's capable of, not trying to hold people accountable for what they said they were going to do, but understanding what the system's capable of and what it needs to do to deliver to the value of the business. If they're willing to take that role, the organization's got the wind at their back, and they can learn and evolve as a team, which is what I did, right? I came into the organization. I hadn't led a large software organization. I took over this and understood what the business needed and had a very talented group of people working with me and for me that I got to learn from and adjust. And so, I tease people. I got a PhD in software engineering just by doing the Bill Hewlett thing of wandering around and figuring out what was working, what was going on. And I spent all my time wandering around talking to people, and I used the metrics to tell me how the complex system was evolving and to go learn where to have conversations about what wasn't happening that we wanted to happen and why it wasn't happening. And I took that mental concept as my job as a leader is to fundamentally learn how it's evolving and learn what's getting in the way so I can help influence priorities to make this much more likely to happen. Because if we didn't get this re-architecture done, the HP laser bit business was dead, because we were never going to release another product in the old architecture, which was a wisdom from above, and we weren't going to get that done. And so we had to get this done or else. And there were a lot of my friends, a lot of my coworkers that livelihood depended on getting this done. And so every day we're trying to figure out how to get better and how to learn and how to adjust and how to adapt. And I see so many leaders say, well, I did Agile, I hired the consultants, now I need to hold them accountable for what we said we needed. And it's just so different from the approach that we took at HP. And the approach that we took at HP easily delivered 2 to 3x improvements in productivity and business results. And everywhere I go that's doing Agile, even if I do this workshop and make the work visible, then they're like, well, I don't even know as a leader how I get work into the system anymore. The product owners tell all the teams what to do. And it was like, really? You just completely sort of just checked out? And then you expect, what do you get the salary for?
I want to go back a little bit to something you said earlier, because I think this is very germane to where we're at in the conversation and where I think maybe we take it next. Is you said earlier, what part of the problem is that people haven't seen what success looks like. And I've said very similar things in the past. The difference, I think that what we're talking about here is genuinely, without any hyperbole, a paradigm shift. This is a dramatically different take on what software development is and how it works. And the problem with the paradigm shift is that the rules, the same rules don't apply in two different paradigms. And so there are questions that you can't answer in one paradigm that seem fundamental in another. And I think that's part of the challenge of making this mental leap, particularly in leaders in organizations, that if they've never seen what good software development looks like, which is the way that I'd put it, which is rather provocatively perhaps, but I think that's the truth. Most people working in the industry have never seen good software development. And that's a terrifying idea, but I think it's a reasonable summary. So if they've never seen it, then it's kind of like being, you know, one of the 12 steps in Alcoholics Anonymous is first recognize that you have a problem. You know, if you don't recognize that you have a problem, how do you get people to start taking this seriously and start doing what I think you and I would advise people to do to make the change, to start changing things? How do you do that? How do you start moving organizations on?
Well, two things. One is, I agree that once you've done the transformation, it's a big shift.
Yeah.
So at HP, I had a bunch of people work for me and they left and they went to different companies. Like, you got to come talk to my company. You can't believe how they're doing software development here. It's like, but in the beginning, one of the things we said is, you know, we used to have all these branches for these different products and we're going to have one main trunk. And I don't know how we're going to do that, but we're going to do that. I would have people argue with me till the cows come home. They would want to, it's like, I don't know how to do it, but we just can't afford to do it the way we've been doing it. And finally, Roger Tweed came up with this idea that says that we're going to have an XML file that's going to describe it. The code's going to call it. We're going to runtime configure. And he came up with a solution. It was like breakthrough. But the organization struggled with it for a long time and they couldn't see it happening. And I think when you describe it as a paradigm shift from an organizational change management, you're scaring people away.
Yeah, true.
I
would say that I still think it's a paradigm shift, but I think you're right. I don't think that's useful language to use to convince people.
Exactly. So I tend to think about it in terms of, if we want to create a system where software developers can get better, I think we should provide them feedback quicker. It's not a matter of controlling the process, the building quality. It's a matter of giving the best quality feedback we can as quick as we can.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. You can argue with that. I mean, it's pretty basic. It's like, okay, so how slow is our feedback now? And I do these feedback delay charts that sort of show, here's the cycle time and what it takes from a developer checking the code to getting it in the hands of customers. Here's the steps that it goes through. Here's where we're finding the defects. This tells you, on average, what's our feedback like? Okay, as an organization, do we think we could get better if we gave them better feedback quicker? Okay, sure, that makes sense. Yeah, we could try that. Yeah. And then I focus on getting people to take small steps. You know, the HP, if you would have told us where we were going to end up and sort of said you can make that and put together a plan to make, to a person on my staff would have said, no way, it's impossible, we can't do it, it won't work. Instead, it's like, okay, if we think about here's the types of things we could improve, as a leadership team, what do we think are the most important things to improve? And then let's break that down into what progress do we think we can make in the next 30 days? And if you look at organizational change management experts like Jonah Berger, you will see him say, well, make it reversible, mm-hmm. make it within the people's zone of acceptance. Let them pick an idea that fits within their zone of acceptance. Let them try some things, make it triable, make it easy. And so you don't, you know, I think one of the biggest mistakes the DevOps community said is, the way you do DevOps is like this. right? If you know, you got to have a team of 5 to 7 people. They got to wear a pager. They got to loan everything. And if you go into an organization, I mean, if Jez and you would have, or Gene and Jez would have come into HP with that proposal when at the beginning, no, just go away. That's not going to work.
But just to be clear, I don't think they would have come in with that proposal. They would have done what you said. They would have said, do a value stream analysis and figure out where your low hanging fruit is.
Yeah. But when you go to the DevOps Enterprise Summit, they sort of propose, you know, let's do these small teams, let's empower them, let's get it. Yeah. And I've had these arguments with Jez, and it's like, okay, I've got, you know, hundreds of people working together. And he goes, no, you need small teams, 5 to 7, 5 to 7, 5 to 7. Yeah. And the Nicole's book that they did with Gene and Jez that came out, the Accelerate.
Yeah.
You know, I've been having this argument on how do you deal with large, complex systems.
Yeah.
With Gene and Jeff since the first DevOps Enterprise Summit, and they finally tested for it and said, okay, here's what the people that are doing DevOps right have. And the number one indicator is they have loosely coupled systems.
Yeah.
So if you go into a large organization with a tightly coupled system and say, the first thing we need to do is completely re-architect everything, I think you're going to see resistance to change.
Yeah. I just to put my cards on the table, I think I come from a different background to them. So mostly I'd characterize, maybe not necessarily the same scale as you, but mostly my background is in larger, more complex systems.
Right.
So mostly, certainly as a consultant, I've been involved in much bigger, much more complicated systems. And so, as you say, I think I would agree that there's a lean in the state of DevOps stuff a little bit towards the kind of simpler, smaller scale, you know,
right,
one-off apps or whatever else. And with bigger, more complicated systems, there are other ways of addressing those. But I still think the principles are the same. So the principles are you want fast feedback, you want to optimize
right.
for fast feedback, and you want to optimize so that you can make change safely and get the feedback on your change. And the technical strategies that we use to employ to apply those principles are very different depending on whether you're building a serverless app or something like that and a big complex system like the HP LaserJet system or some of the systems that I've worked on. But the idea is the same. It's dealing with that complex adaptive system, and for that you need to be able to try stuff out, see what works, and correct the things that don't. As Kenefin says, we want to probe, sense, and respond.
And I agree fundamentally with that at the principal level. It works really well.
Yeah.
What I'm concerned about is when you go into organizations and you say the word DevOps,
yeah.
People see that I've got these independent teams roguely pushing code into and wearing pagers, and it's so far away from how they're currently doing things that they say that doesn't work. And so I step back from that and go to, okay, we need a system where we can provide better feedback to the people that are developing this code as quick as we possibly can.
Yeah.
And got a lot of repetitive processes that are manually forcing large batch sizes, which slow us down or prone to errors and have these different types of problems. It gets really hard to localize the feedback to an individual developer when you're working in large batch sizes. If you're working
Yes.
in much smaller batch sizes, you can localize them and give them that feedback better. And you
yeah.
don't need a team of people trying to analyze and figure out which engineer it was that caused the problem, because the people in that small batch size can do that. So can we work towards that direction? And if so, what are the biggest challenges in our organizations? And those are the kind of cross-team things
yeah.
that I think we need to make visible, the leaders need to make visible, and they need to be influencing those things if you're going to make those improvements. And if I go in and say the word DevOps, and they assume it's, I got to re-architect for a team of 5 to 7 people to push code into the thing, their resistance to change is going to go way up. They're not going to embrace these new ways of working. And if we can just make the process visible, make the waste visible, give people opportunities to pick ideas that were in within their zone of acceptance to try.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd even say it's less important that they start in the right place than that as a leadership team that they agree on where to start. Because if you're going to take an adaptive, iterative approach, as a team, if you start together, you can learn and adapt together.
Yeah.
And you'll learn and adapt to the places that are causing you the most friction.
It's one of the huge advantages of organizing around fast, high quality feedback is that it doesn't matter what choice you make. As long as you've got a measuring stick to see whether you're moving closer to your goal or further away from it, you can start making change randomly and then say, no, that one's moving us further away. Let's discard that and pick the ones that move us closer. So that's the mechanism, it seems to me, that really drives this whole process and of change. So you know, we establish a functional criteria on which we can measure whether we get closer to our goal or not. Whatever that measure is, it doesn't really matter, but we establish some way of determining whether we're moving in the right direction or not. And then we can start trying stuff. And that way we will ultimately hit the goal, even if the target moves.
And I think the difference with software is the same team, the same organization is responsible for the product and the process.
Mm-hmm.
In manufacturing, you have an organization that designs the product and optimizes that.
Yeah.
And then it hand it off to the other team that optimizes the process to make it efficient for how they deliver that product over and over again. And I think with this stuff.
That seems to me like a category error rather than different. Fundamentally, that seems to me that, you know, because absolutely what you're saying is you've got the kind of the product design activity and then the production activity is the way that I would think of it.
Right.
And the production problem is never our problem, because that's just, we can clone things perfectly for zero cost in software. So our problem is all about the first part and nothing to do with the second part, because the second part is simple.
But I think of the production process as, once you check in code, how does it get an environment built? How does it get the product built? How does it get deployed? How does it get tested? How does it go through all those steps to getting hand from you writing a piece of code that you worked with the business to solve something? How does it get from there into the hands of the customer? And I think of that as the manufacturing process, where a lot of organizations, those can be repeatable steps that tend to take a lot of labor and manual effort that forces large batch sizes that are inefficient.
So I don't think that we're disagreeing on optimizing that. I don't think of that as part of the production process, really, because it's the same, you know, if let's say, I don't know, I've got, let's say we were designing this cup for manufacturer, then you know, I'd probably be building a prototype that I could evaluate and see whether it held coffee and see whether it was, you know, I could hold it in my hand and all of those sorts of things, and it didn't dissolve when we washed it. So we want to try all of those things out. That's still part of the design of it, really, rather than the production. The production is when we take this and make it available en masse as a product. That's what production really means. It's the creation of a product, and in software terms, I would say that, you know, the building of the software, the creation of the stream of bytes that represents our product, is the design part, and we want to optimize to get fast feedback on that so that we can learn and figure out, no, that cup's not very good, so we want to change it. We want to get fast feedback on that. And then when we've got a stable version that we like, you know, that's something that we can kind of, in our terms, from software point of view, release essentially for free, because the cost of the actual production of the, you know, the bytes is so low.
And if you think of it that way, yes, there's no manufacturing in software because it's done. But as somebody who grew up as a process engineering manufacturing, how you create the product is all those steps that you go through from when you've written the code to when it's ready to hand to the customer. And there are things you can use a lot of what Goldratt taught us. Where's the bottleneck in the process?
Sure.
Right? And frequently that can be the release process.
Absolutely. I don't think we're disagreeing on that. I think I'm going to stop at this point because we're probably just counting angels on the head of a pin. I think largely we're agreeing with different words. So absolutely that, you know, I think there are some interesting things when we talk about doing software at scale. Fundamentally, it seems to me that there are two strategies, and a lot of the DevOps documentation talks about one, which I think is a mistake. So I think that we're in agreement there. So I think that the two strategies are to divide stuff up so everything's developed by individual teams so that they can make change without impacting on anybody else. That's kind of what I'd think of as the microservice approach. And that's great, the most scalable way of doing things if that's what you want to do, and it's not right for all kinds of software. Or you build bigger systems and you make sure that you've got feedback that's fast enough and efficient enough so that you can still sustain the ability to make change in small steps and get fast feedback and definitive feedback on the quality of your change, whatever the scale of the system. And you can do this at vast scales of hugely complex software. SpaceX are updating space rockets, using these techniques 40 minutes before a launch. So you can do this at vast scales in complex systems, but fundamentally it's about evaluating. The soundbite that I use in continuous delivery terminology is we're going to organize our work so that we're working to maintain our software in a releasable state at all times. Whatever that takes, that's kind of our target. And if we've got a big complex system, that's coupled. What we need to do is that we need to optimize to be able to evaluate all of those coupled pieces together very quickly and very efficiently. If we've got a distributed system that's made up of many discrete independent components, that's easier in some ways and harder in others. It raises the bar for design challenges, but simplifies the bit that you're talking about, production, the actual generation of the code and the evaluation of those changes. But both of them are essentially doing the same thing. We've got to evaluate what we're going to release. So we scope these things on independently releasable units.
Yeah. And I would say ideally you want those loosely coupled teams that can work independently because it's going to be easier and more. I would just say that if you're starting with a large tightly coupled system, there's probably a lot of more low-hanging fruit than changing.
Absolutely. 100%, and that's the world where I work mostly.
So. Yeah, and having a re-architecture forced upon me is something I never recommend lightly. And if you're going to do it, go read everything by Martin Fowler and see if you can take an evolutionary approach as opposed to Big Bang, because they're painful, hard, and difficult, and don't often deliver what you're hoping.
Yeah, absolutely, and the challenge, I think, that the mistake is that so many organizations fall between those two stools. Most organizations with a legacy of code and software development practice want to keep doing what they're doing, which is building things as a big coherent whole, but they want the freedom to be able to have these small teams. They think that they want the freedom to have these small teams and divide the problem up into what they think of as microservices, but they can't resist the urge to test everything together before they release it. So now they've got all of the costs of one version of solving this problem and all of the costs of the other with none of the benefits of either, which just seems like crazy to me.
And in a lot of situations, you don't own deployment.
Yeah.
In the laser jet printers, when was the last time you updated the firmware on your printer?
Yeah.
And it's hard to do A/B testing. It's hard to do a lot of the things that you would consider. And so different systems have different problems. And a lot of what I try to do with EDT is how do we make the different processes visible? How do we teach people how to analyze how they're set up doing software development. How do we make it visible so that they can agree on it? And then, how do we get people to learn those new methods and apply them? And what I realize is the organizations I work with get a lot of value out of it and see it, but when you go off and try to talk to organizations about it, they're either selling a big complex framework, they're selling software, or they're selling butts in seats. There aren't very many people in the world like you and I out there that are truly just trying to help organizations figure out how to help themselves.
Yeah.
And probably because it's not that good of a business, right? But when you've done this and you've realized the impact it can have on both yourself and your business and your coworkers, you just want to help people realize how different the world can be, and help them sort of get past all the places where you stubbed your toes, so that it's okay to make mistakes, but let's make new ones. Let's not make the same ones we've made over and over again.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, it's the definition of an expert, somebody that's screwed up in lots of different interesting ways.
Yeah. Oh, don't do it that way, because
That doesn't
we've
work.
tried
I don't
that
know
one
what.
already.
I think this might work, but I definitely know that doesn't work. Cool. I think we're probably coming to the end of our time. I want to thank you again for your time. Is there anything else that we should have talked about from your point of view that we haven't?
The interesting thing to me is how AI is potentially changing how you transfer in software development. And how do you think about applying AI as you're a leader and trying to influence how this complex adaptive system is evolving versus how do you do AI as a developer? And I'm seeing a lot of this stuff focused around what do you do with AI as a developer, and not so much about, as I'm a leader of an organization and I'm trying to, maybe I've got a bunch of products and I got a bunch of branches and I want to abstract from the product definitions. Can I use AI to analyze my software code that's really hard to see and figure out? And figure out where you're going around the APIs in such a way that forces me to branch for the different code things. Are there things where, gee, I want to move to the cloud? Where am I making calls directly to the hardware? Can I analyze that? Can I monitor that? Can I make sure that doesn't happen? What are the things that are slowing me down? And one of the things that, I've always kind of come with this idea that, if I go into a large organization that's mainly releasing code with manual testing, how do you move forward? And the worst kind of tests to write are system tests, because they're hard to maintain, they're difficult to deal with, and hard to, and ideally you should have unit tests that are better for the developer, that give you better feedback, easier to debug and do all those sorts of things. But if I'm a large organization, and so as an engineer, I want to take the system test approach, I want to do all that. But as a leader, how long is it going to take for me to put enough unit testing in place to enable me to turn off the manual testing? So I've always come to the conclusion that, the first and most important thing you need to do is learn how to work in smaller batch sizes that don't have the overhead with all the debug and triage. And so ideally, you want to remove manual testing as a quality gate. It's not that you'd still do it for exploratory or usability or all those sorts of different things, but don't use it as a gate in your release process. And to do that, you need to kill the manual system tests you've been doing. And the easiest way to do that is through automating the system tests. But then there was this interesting paper by Meta where they went in and had AI write unit tests for legacy code. And they did it a couple of ways. One, they sort of said, create unit tests and then sort of throw it away if it doesn't build and compile. And then two, throw it away if it doesn't pass. And so they did some things like that to filter it back. But it's like, well, wait a minute. Could AI really automate unit tests to the point where I don't? And it's not the way you'd want to write them when you're writing the code. But if you've got a large legacy application, you're trying to figure out how to modernize it. Or can it, or, and there's another thing that was really interesting. Martin Fowler wrote with the ThoughtWorks person out of China that says, when you use AI, just don't tell it to do something. Start with a stepwise approach and iteration where you ask it, how would you approach this problem? And then you do some feedback and iteration with AI, and then you respond to that. And then, okay, now that I agreed that that is the way I design it, that's the way I approach it, now can you do this step? So, you know, if I've got a bunch of manual tests that are doing system tests, okay, given all these manual tests, how would you approach writing the Gherkin type code for this? And then once I've got good code like that, I've done it for a few, then could that scale and quickly go across? It may not be ready yet, but it's moving quickly. And you know, I'm talking to engineers all the time about what's working. And you know, one point it's like, oh, it's terrible, I can't stand it, it's not working. 5 weeks later, it's saying, well, it's actually working pretty good. And I even had an engineer go to talk to me the other day. So he's like, you know, I found that if I'm polite to it, it works better. Gee, that was a really nice job. I really liked the way you did that. It, what if we try? He says it's weird. It shouldn't really work, but I seem to get better results with a dice.
I'm a bit skeptical about some of that in terms of the role of AI. From a testing point of view, I'm nervous that what AI can only possibly do, if we just kind of point it at a code base and say test this, all it can do is assert that the code's doing what the code's doing, and that's not what we really want. We want to know that the code's doing the right things, and there's no way that the AI can know what the right things are without some form of human input. I think that one of the directions that's really interesting is that as we get to more advanced versions of the kind of AI tools, what we'll end up with, I hope, is that we effectively will raise the level of abstraction of programming, so that we'll be programming by defining specifications for the behavior that we want of the system, which probably will look a bit like some of those Gherkin things. And say, we want the software to do this. We want the software to achieve this. And then the AI fills in the gaps and makes it do that. But I'm nervous about the use of AI in legacy systems, because there are other techniques that allow us to do that and we don't need AI for. But they're more limited in terms of, seems to me. But it's an interesting problem. And as you say, the AI stuff is moving so quickly. I mean, I'm involved with a few people that are doing some interesting things with AI and looking into it for a variety of different reasons. And it's obvious, it's pretty obvious that it's going to be a huge player. I'm also intrigued by the thing that you said about what are the AI tools that help lead the leaders, the leadership. It's not just a technical problem. So how do we facilitate this? And partly maybe it is about that raising the level of abstraction of programming to the level where it can just say, I want a trading system that will give me this result, and then something generates that isn't a person.
I think we're a long ways. Yes, you could use AI to sort of say create this, and then create something and kick it out. You'd probably die under the weight of maintaining it.
Absolutely. That's also a big problem. I think that one of the huge things that's missing, that's kind of implicit in nearly all that we've said this afternoon, is, you and I have been talking in some detail about the importance and the value of incremental change. We've been talking about how vital it is to make progress in small steps. And whatever the mental capacity that we have, one of the advantages of being able to make progress in small steps is, if my head's this big, then I can only conceive a problem that's kind of that large. But if I can break a problem down into a series of small steps, I can do that large, then that large, then that large, then that large, and add to it. AI doesn't currently work like that because it can't go back and rework. AI currently, we say, do this thing, and it does it. It generates all of it in one big step, and that means there's a limit on how big the AI can get. Even if AI can get 1,000 times smarter than us, you can only build systems that are 1,000 times smarter than us.
But I think that Martin Fowler paper gets past that a little bit, which is you don't say, "Give me X." You start with how would you approach this problem? And as a good experienced software developer, you iterate on that until you've got an approach that works. And then you
I'm skeptical in that I don't think that goes far enough, because one of the I've got a video coming up on my YouTube channel on this topic, but one of the things that I think that we're in danger of discarding is the incrementalism, the ability to sustain incrementalism, because currently the current generation of AI code generation tools aren't reproducible. So we're not able to build on what we know works. Because every time we ask the AI to give us a result, even given the same input parameters, the same specifications, we get a different result every time.
Yeah.
So that limits incrementalism.
But HP, I was so focused on making developers more productive. I was buying them larger screens. I was buying them noise canceling headsets. I think if you're a leader in an organization that isn't having your organization experiment and learn and adjust with it, you should be questioning why you're getting paid.
Absolutely, 100%. I'm not trying to downgrade the utility of the AI tools. I think they are important, and I am convinced that they're only going to get better than they are now, and one day they'll be doing all of the coding. But at the moment, I think there are limitations on what we're doing, and I think that some of the approaches to applying them are, to be frank, somewhat naive.
I don't think they'll be replacing software engineers. I think they'll be making software engineers more productive. And I think AI is a long ways out from ever writing software. If you think of this example of, I go through a bunch of iterations until it's writing good Gherkin code for me, and it can look at my manual test and write good Gherkin code. I would think it's not that hard to write the step definitions to, and so that repetitive work of writing the step definitions is something that could, but every time it kicks it out, I want a design review by a good quality engineer that looks for the weaknesses. And I don't want to sort of say, do it for the whole thing. I want to say, let's do some small iterations until we get this working right, and then give me a bunch of feedback, and then let's try to scale it out a little bit. But I think it's a human in the loop approach, as opposed to AI is going to do something. And we're not looking to replace engineers. We're looking to make it more productive.
I think that's going to be true. I think that's practically true for more difficult systems for a long time. But I think the dystopian view, we're already down that track somewhere, that, there's data that's saying that the quality of software is going down with the application of AI, because people aren't doing that checking. And there are a lot of the tools, they're not designed with that sort of checking in mind. And I would go back to the stuff that we were talking about, is the use of automated testing as a tool, from my point of view as an engineering discipline, to drive the change, is part of exerting that kind of control over these things.
And I want to be writing my unit tests when I'm writing my code.
Yeah.
It's just, how do I deal with something that I'm never going to go back and write those unit tests on, just because it's been around for long, and the value of writing unit tests goes way down when the code's already written.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's going to be interesting to see how it evolves. I think it's a human in the loop thing, but boy, it the thing I don't see is, how's AI being used by leaders to help me understand how this complex adaptive system is evolving?
And that's, I think, absolutely, that's true. That's an interesting area. I don't know. I have no clue what those tools would even look like to be able to do that.
And nobody's focused on it, right? And
absolutely,
they're all focused on the latest, greatest thing that AI can do, and all these sorts of things. And the change in the impact it's going to have for software development is more on the adoption and by people that are running businesses, not by OpenAI and those different things. And so
yeah,
those people need to understand what it's going to do, and they need to understand they need to be influencing how the tools evolve and what they're going to be doing. And I just have not found the spot where that conversation is going on with AI.
No, I think perhaps one of the areas that might be interesting to explore for somebody in that space is maybe around the metrics that we were talking about before that are so important in terms of steering your change and figuring out whether your change is working or not.
Yeah, monitoring how systems evolve. I mean,
yeah.
It'd be great if you had a really good AI system that was optimizing your A/B testing,
figuring out which absolutely
code is being used, which code isn't being used, and you know,
did this feature make me money?
None of this code's been used for like 3 years. Should we still test it and release it every cycle, or should we get rid of it?
There's certainly some work being done on that. So Adam Tornhill, who runs a company called CodeScene, has tools that do some of that stuff, which is doing that kind of analysis based on your version control system and your change history. It's interesting stuff, but what's the Chinese proverb? Maybe we live in interesting times.
Right. And the interesting, it's changing so fast. It's just hard to, for an old guy like me, it's hard to keep up with.
Yeah, and I think I'm probably older than you. Anyway, thank you very much. It's been a delight talking to you, Gary. It's been a lot of fun. Thank you for listening. These discussions are aimed at helping us all to push our discipline forward. If we've helped to change your perspective on the things that we discussed here today, please do leave the podcast a review, as it will help us a lot to reach a wider audience with our show. Also, let us know on Twitter or other social media channels if you've got suggestions for guests that we really should talk to. Similarly, if you have any thoughts on our discussion here today, please do let us know. The best way to get in contact with us is through our Discord, which you can access via Patreon. So if you enjoyed this episode today, please do consider supporting the show, either directly through Patreon or by leaving us a review.